You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Solving a crime through forensic medicine is a lot more difficult than they make it look on CSI. So imagine the challenges faced by investigators 100 years ago, conducting autopsies in low-lit, overheated spaces, or even in fields, or by lamplight in the nearest barn. Douglas Starr was on the show back in January to discuss his book, The Killer of Little Shepherds, a true crime story and the birth of forensic science, in which he tells the story of Joseph Haché and Dr. Alexandre Lacassonnier and the crime spree that led to the birth of modern forensic medicine. Mr. Starr is co-director of the Center for Science and Medical Journalism and a professor of journalism at Boston University, and we thought we would re-air our conversation for you today. I start off by asking Douglas Starr, who was Joseph Haché? Did he have a history of violence?
He did. Nowadays, you would call him the classic psychotic. As a kid, he didn't have much of a sense of humor. And if his friends played a joke on him, his response would be to try to kill them. He spent time in the army, where he obsessed over a young woman. And when she turned him down, he tried to kill her. He was put in an asylum for a while. And after he was let out, he embarked on a four-year killing spree.
Now, what about that asylum? The Dole Asylum? Would it be called Dole in French?
Yeah, there were two. There was the Dole Asylum and the Saint-Robert Asylum. And they thought they had cured him, and I guess it didn't take.
Well, what kind of treatment would he have received in the late 19th century? They called them insane asylums, but weren't they really snake pits?
No. Well, what was interesting about this period and what attracted me to it was, in many ways, it was the birth of the modern era. And one of the things that was modernized at this time was the treatment of the mentally ill. Whereas formerly the treatment would be to chain them to a wall and beat them or squirt them with cold water when they misbehaved, these asylums were really quite gentle, humanistic places. And I visited them and I was quite impressed.
But one of the reasons he was released was it was overcrowded, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Kind of like what we've seen in California more recently.
Again, the more things change. I visited the asylum at Saint-Robert, the last place he was, and was able to get his records. And he had calmed down considerably, and they thought he was better. And there was economic pressure to let him go, and they let him go on April Fool's Day, 1894. And 5 weeks after that, he killed his first victim.
And do we know why?
Why he killed?
Yeah, I mean, was it just for the thrill of the kill?
You know, I spoke to modern forensic psychologists about this, and they said he really fit the pattern of the classic psychotic serial killer. This feeling of pent-up rage would build up in him, and he would find someone in an isolated circumstance, often a shepherd, which is how he got that nickname, and he would kill them and mutilate them horribly.
Usually with serial killers, it's people who remind the killer of somebody else. Kills prostitutes, others kill elderly people because they have that kind of anger. Shepherds?
He was a
just
pederast.
Because they were easy to.
He was a very cunning predator, and the best way to find somebody in an isolated situation was to go for a shepherd at the time. It's funny you mentioned prostitutes. Well, not funny, but 10 years before, Jack the Ripper became internationally famous by killing 5 prostitutes in a particular neighborhood of London. In the 1890s, Joseph Haché killed anywhere from 11 to 25 young people over the entire geography of France. So this guy was a real bad actor.
And were people aware of the fact that there was a serial killer at loose, especially because they had been very aware of what happened in England with Jack the Ripper?
They didn't put the pieces together. Communication wasn't what it is today. You know, this wasn't the tourist brochure of France. Outside of Paris, it was quite primitive. People had ox carts. They didn't have telegraphs in many towns. And his method would be he would kill someone in an isolated place, change clothes, walk 20 miles or so into the next district where they never heard of him. And it took a long time for anybody to put these pieces together.
But this was also the time of the height of popularity of Sherlock Holmes novels. I would have assumed that somebody would have been intrigued by what was going on and try to emulate Holmes.
Well, Holm emulated my guys. The hero of the book is Dr. Alexandre Lacassagne, who was the foremost forensic scientist of his day, one of the creators of the field. And interestingly enough, he was a real enthusiast of the Holmes stories, which appeared during his career. So much so that he had a graduate student write a paper about Holmes, comparing the science of Sherlock Holmes to the science of their day. And it's as though somebody wrote a paper about CSI nowadays. They said, look, this was really fun, but Holmes never conducted an autopsy. And they just went right down the list of all the things Holmes didn't do. But again, they thought it was great fun. When you said, didn't somebody finally put the pieces together after 4 years of killings, two people put it together, a small-town magistrate named Emile Fourquet, who had followed the development of the field and used very modern methods, and then eventually Dr. Lacassagne.
Now, they were doing autopsies on the victims, but
yes.
Would they have been the same through the same procedures wherever the autopsies were conducted?
Well, it could be pretty rough. As you said in the intro, a lot of times the autopsies would be done on a field or on the kitchen table of the relatives. In one case, they were done on the mayor's table in town hall. So some of the rural autopsies were not that scientific, but that was part of Lacassagne's mission to standardize this.
And what did he do? Did he send out the rules of autopsy all throughout France?
He basically did. I mean, at his institute in Lyon, he developed something called observation pages, in which doctors would follow a particular set of procedures so that they could get standardized autopsies. This was a huge advance at the time.
What broke the case that led to Vacher's capture?
A few things. First of all, this magistrate I mentioned, Mr. Fourquet, followed modern methods, and he created probably one of the first real criminal profiles in that he had started collecting any testimony people gave about any strange vagabonds they'd seen, any evidence from crime scenes, and he started putting them together in charts. And he underlined in blue everything that went together, and he finally sent out telegrams to all the districts of France saying, if you see a man who looks like this, a scar, a paralyzed eye, et cetera, and if you have a murder that fits these descriptions, please send the cases to me. So 85 cases were sent to him, and eventually he sent out word, and Vacher did make a mistake during one of his assaults and get caught.
And then they linked him to all the other murders that he had committed.
Very cleverly, I might add.
Cleverly in what way?
Well, at the time, the standard way of interrogating somebody was to round up the usual suspects, put them in stress positions or torture them until somebody said, confessed. Sound familiar? At the time, criminologists were writing that the stupidest thing you could do is actually torture somebody, and what you really want to do is befriend them and use guile. So Fourquet, in a very interesting series of interrogations, tricked Vacher into confessing.
It's really weird that we're still having that debate about whether to use torture or not today.
Yeah, by the 1880s, they knew it was useless.
My guest is Douglas Starr. You are the co-director of the Center for Science and Medical Journalism, professor of journalism, writing about medical and science matters, not criminal matters. How did you wind up writing about a criminal case?
The kind of science journalism I like is the big stories. Science sort of is a lens through which to see the human endeavor. And like many Americans, I was interested in science and forensics and science and justice. And I was in the basement of Harvard Medical School one day and tripped over a report of this case and realized so many of the fascinating elements of forensics were created right about at this time that I felt I had to tell the story.
Well, this is at a time when the evolving science of the Industrial Revolution was changing the way things were done, including the way a crime scene was approached.
Absolutely. Pasteur was alive, Darwin was alive, Freud was alive. All of these wonderful sciences were coming together. And the criminologists realized for the first time that you really could use evidence to work backwards and tell the story.
This is around the time that the British started using fingerprinting.
Fingerprinting came a little bit after this, but it's the same era.
Although the reason I mention that is because Francis Galton, who introduced fingerprinting to Britain, also coined the term eugenics. And eugenics was part of the approach at the time. They saw that as scientific.
Absolutely, because part of their inquiry, in addition to figuring out who committed the crime, was to ask why they committed the crime. And you have to realize this was the period where the question of good and evil expanded beyond the clergy into the scientists and the new profession of psychology. So they really started doing analysis of criminals. They dissected their brains after they were executed to really understand what is the neurological basis of this instinct.
And they had people like Cesare Lombroso who believed that if your face was asymmetrical, you were likely to be a criminal.
Yep, he felt criminals bored. And La Cassagna felt
it was the environment. I wonder if Brian Williams knows about that. The modern technology.
There are some strange ideas out there which persist to this day.
And then refrigeration had come along around this time, so they could actually preserve the body of a corpse?
They could in the Paris morgue. In fact, one of the most popular attractions in all of Paris was the morgue, which had department store-type windows, and they'd have bodies displayed. 25,000 people a day would come through to look because that's how they identified bodies. In other cities, they just had to work quickly.
Had other people been arrested and convicted of committing some of the murders that Vaché had actually committed?
Yes, that was the collateral damage. It was a time of great superstition, of great suspicion, and oftentimes in a small village where a child was found mutilated, they'd pick on the local scapegoat and convict him or drive him from town. There was a lot of damage due to this case.
Another important figure in this story is Alphonse Bertillon. Who's he?
Yeah. He was a colleague of La Cassagne's in Paris who developed a system we now know as biometry. Before fingerprints, he figured out that if you took 11 critical measurements of a person, you know, from the elbow to the finger, for example, and combine that to a number, that number could identify a person down to a factor of 1 in 4 million. So it presaged what we use today, for example, in eyeball scanners and other biometric devices.
And it seems to me that reading the accounts that you've compiled, Vaché should have been caught sooner than he was.
Yeah, he was terribly clever. You know, he was a veteran and often would show his army papers to get out. He was in and out of small town prisons a number of times. But you know, serial killers do that. I mean, Jeffrey Dahmer's, remember they had him and he talked his way out of it. So these people were very clever.
Did he ever confess to the murders?
Vaché?
Mm-hmm.
This inspector tricked him into confessing, and immediately after that, he started really pushing for the insanity defense. And this is when La Cassagne was brought in to do a real analysis of what happened.
This sounds so much like the sort of thing that we read about today in the newspapers.
You know, I mentioned to you earlier, I got this information by going to the asylums and getting the records and going to the courthouses. And I was reading these 120-year-old records. I felt like it was being ripped from today's headlines.
Mm. Because they were starting to talk about what is the nature of evil and whether somebody who can be called insane and not wind up being punished for doing something like this.
Absolutely.
So what did they decide in the case of Vaché?
You know, I'll be giving it away, but eventually La Cassagne presented such a compelling case that this man had planned his crimes and cleverly escaped that they eventually did find that he was legally sane to go to trial and to be executed. By the way,
But he was insane.
You know, this is the enduring question. You and I look at this guy and say this guy was nuts, but almost no serial killers are ever found to be insane because the law is set up in such a way that if you could plan, you have enough consciousness to be legally responsible. That may change in the days ahead.
You write about some other serial killers in this book as well. Do you see similarities in all their cases? There's one famous case that took place in the Soviet Union where a man was not caught partly because they didn't want to admit to having that a series of crimes being committed.
Yeah, I think the similarities you see in this or in Ted Bundy or the BTK case is these are people without pity and without empathy and tend to be very clever and they could turn on the charm when they need to. It doesn't make them less than a human being, but it's just a very, very complicated form of human being.
Did the case change the way police approach these kinds of cases around the world?
I think it did. I would say that it was the only case that changed it, but I think after this, people got much more methodical about their profiles, about their autopsies, about putting the evidence together. To tell you the truth, if we followed the methods that they followed in those days, we'd still probably be better off than we are now.
Why?
Well, if you look at the work of the Innocence Project, a lot of cases have been overturned because of bad work from forensic laboratories. You know, we see CSI on TV and we think it's perfect. In truth, it's a pretty raggedy situation with some good labs and some bad ones. And people like La Cassagne felt that forensic work should be pure science. And now there's a little bit of political involvement.
So what were the procedures that he instituted that everybody had to apply when they were doing an autopsy?
There were quite a lot, but he also figured out how to tie a bullet to a gun, how to examine the position of the body, how to look for signs of where the body fell, how to look for blood spatter analysis. You know, they would approach the body from a distance and take copious notes all the way to the point of autopsy. It was quite thorough.
And you say that if we simply followed Lacassagne's approaches, that we would still be doing good forensics today.
Yeah, it's not to say we're not. And he would have been delighted to have DNA evidence. But I recently had a medical examiner tell me, boy, I wish this guy was my boss. He was he was the guy.
Douglas Starr's book is called The Killer of Little Shepherds, A True Crime Story on the Birth of Forensic Science. It's published by Knopf. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks so much.